All right, I think I'm going to go ahead and get started on another presentation on client object model protocols for SharePoint. Okay, so in order to start talking about the client object model, I want to give you a little bit of a landscape of where this fits in the broad scheme of schemas, if you will. When you look at sort of the landscape for things that you can call on the client that talk into SharePoint, this is obviously a bit of an oversimplification, but how we talk about it with developers frequently is that there's a number of different things that you might want to access inside of SharePoint. There's sort of core SharePoint concepts, things like sites and webs and lists and libraries. There's things that we call the workloads. So this means things like social APIs, taxonomy, things that are sort of more specific. Obviously, a lot of what's inside of SharePoint are things like files. So that's one of the core things that SharePoint does is manage a set of files. So frequently you want to get at those as if it was a file share. So there's some APIs related to files. And then another big part of SharePoint is lists. And so we have a number of APIs for getting at lists. I think you might have heard about list.asmx earlier in the day, but we also have some new APIs for OData and for accessing them through a REST-style API that I'll talk about as well. One of the really interesting new APIs that we've offered that's available remotely is something we call the client object model. It's alternatively referred to as the CSOM. And from a protocol perspective, this is called MS-CSOM and MS-CSOM-SPT. With the client object model, it's a fundamentally different approach to how we represent concepts and objects inside of SharePoint. We make them available to callers. So as we'll see, it's kind of an interesting protocol, but it's also very powerful and lets you do lots of interesting things. I won't drill too much into the farms and sites and the various SharePoint concepts. I understand that earlier in the day you had a bit of a review of that as well. Okay, so when you think about the CSOM and the client object model, the fundamental desire for client object model when we first set out to create it for the SharePoint 2010 product, first and foremost was we wanted to move the user experience of SharePoint into something that was a little bit more modern, a little bit more consistent with the kinds of experiences that you see on the web. And what this means is that we wanted the UI to be a bit more responsive, update just in time based on the user's actions, not have lots of page refreshes, that type of thing. In other words, an AJAX, modern, Web 2.0 type of API. And so when we looked at our API surface, we had some SOAP web services and the like, but the idea was to really design an API to make it super efficient to call, especially when you're in the client-side on script. And in particular, a problem that you have when you call things like SOAP web services is that frequently, if you take the set of web services that we have, you may need to make 2 to 3 or 4 round trips in order to actually get all the data you need to take to make an action. So for example, inside of SharePoint, if you want to go delete an item arbitrarily, first you have to go call a web service to get the web information, to get some information about like what the set of lists are. Then you probably want to call a list web service in order to get some more context about the list that's inside of SharePoint that you want to delete from. And then finally, you want to call a third web service maybe to go actually delete the item from the list API. And so those 3 round trips from client to server can frequently be pretty expensive from a user experience point of view. And so the idea was that rather than trying to keep adding these web services through SOAP that do sort of complex sets of operations in one round trip, instead, the idea was to take a different approach and take the APIs that we had on the server, expose them remotely, and then allow for some advanced semantics, things like batching, conditional exceptions, conditional scoping, and that type of thing. But while we're at it, and while we're sort of in this business of exposing SharePoint objects for remote access and letting you call them remotely, wouldn't it be cool if people were developing Windows clients or other clients, that they could also call these APIs as well? And so there's some DLLs that you can use if you're using things like Windows or Silverlight potentially that allow you to call into it. The other thing that we have is we do have an extensive server-side API that allows you to do a lot of diverse things. Only a fraction of that was exposed through web services, through SOAP-based web services, just as a result of requirements and as a result of time and that type of thing. And so with the CSOM, the client object model, it's a goal to make it a lot easier to take things that we have exposed on the server through a process of specification and making sure it's secure, then expose that to remote access in a very simple fashion rather than building just ever-increasing set of SOAP-based web services to go access all that type of behavior. So I'm going to talk about that client object model and what we've decided to expose through it and how it works as a protocol. But I'll also wrap up by talking about our list database, our OData-based list access web service called listdata.svc. It's kind of a cousin to the client object model, and as we think about the future and as we go through in future releases, that type of thing, it's maybe a little more indicative of the kinds of web services that we'll be exposing. So in that regard, it's very forward-looking. Then I'll talk a little bit about SharePoint Online support, although a colleague of mine, Rob Howard, will be coming later in the afternoon, and we'll have more details about that as well. Okay, so CSOM concepts in a very brief nutshell, the client object model, what were we trying to do? So literally, as I mentioned, it started with this process of taking the server-side APIs that we have, the server-side objects that we have. We have an object-oriented .NET API on the server called Microsoft.SharePoint. We wanted to take all those objects and APIs and make them callable remotely. And for the existing set of SharePoint developers, the idea was try to keep the concepts consistent so that if you're using a web object on the server to go update what is a SharePoint site, make sure that there's a web object in the client which has the exact same set of properties that you can go and update and so work with that remotely. So the idea was to keep it consistent with the sets of APIs. So if you've ever developed against SharePoint on the server, the object structures that are represented through this client object model should be very familiar. So once we take those server-side APIs and expose them remotely, what the client object model essentially then becomes is essentially a script. You're essentially defining scripts of calls that should go fire on the server. You're defining that on the client, sending it to the server. That will go ahead and execute and returns results back to the client. What's great about this is it allows for semantics like batching, allowing for the developer of the client to define the set of operations they want to run against the server rather than having to hope that there's one or two web services, SOAP-based web services, that maps to what they're trying to do. And then as a protocol, what it will use under the covers is essentially just custom XML for the request format for defining the set of operations to go fire on the server side. And it uses JSON objects as the response. Again, its lineage, first and foremost, is a way to help make our user experience inside of the web browser a little bit more interactive and more Ajax-y, if you will. Maybe that sort of helps explain why, for example, it will return JSON as a response. But that's the fundamental of how that protocol works. Okay. Oops. So if we look at how this protocol fundamentally functions, what we have is for JavaScript, for .NET, and for Silverlight, we have a DLL called the client object model. And so this is a DLL that has encoded inside of it a library that represents some common SharePoint objects and some common SharePoint properties and methods. And then what it does is it encodes this protocol called the client object model. So typically a use case is somebody builds let's say a Silverlight application or a .NET application that wraps this DLL and calls some APIs on front of it. At the protocol level, what it'll do is it'll take those object model requests that the user makes inside of their client object model, it'll encode that into an XML, it'll look like a set of scripts or operations to go run against the server. Client.svc is a WCF-based web service, but again, the fundamentals of the protocol are XML and JSON. It'll take the set of things that the developer has requested in their script, and it'll go run it against the SharePoint APIs on the server. Those SharePoint APIs will then sort of go update the various things like the SharePoint content database and do the operations that the developer has requested. And then it'll send all that back up through JSON. And then on the client side, that DLL that we have that's in .NET or the JavaScript will decode that and sort of return the response up to the client. So we have a DLL for .NET to make it easier to develop in, and there's some JavaScripts as well. But there's certainly nothing that stops anyone from implementing their own custom client in XML and JSON as well and doing those types of things themselves. But that's the fundamental of how the protocol works.
The client SVC, which group develops that? The SharePoint
So the client.svc is part of SharePoint Foundation, was developed by the core SharePoint Foundation group, and it covers, again, core SharePoint Foundation concepts, things like sites and webs and lists and those types of things.
So it's between the SharePoint MPI and the client.svc is the network, right?
Actually, client.svc is implemented on the same server, so basically there's no network here in ROP. When the SharePoint API executes, that will execute, like, let's say, stored procedures against the database where SharePoint the network is here. So these are like JavaScript clients, .NET clients. There's a network here, and then this calls this endpoint on the SharePoint farm. All right, question?
Yeah, so when you make changes via this API, are they in every way consistent with triggering all the same events that they can change the other API?
Yes, yeah. They basically should be the exact same thing as if you had called these APIs on the server. And so when you think about... there is, when you think about something like list items, there's basically two APIs that we've exposed for updating list items. There's sort of a general update, and then there's what we have called a system update. And when you do a system update, what will happen is it will increment the document, but it won't save a new version, and it won't save the fact that whoever made that call is the one that changed it. So it's a way to sort of make a silent update to a document to maybe sort of affect some properties. Through the client object model, we've exposed the general update mechanism so that when you update a document, it'll create a new version and it'll say, here's the person who did it. The system update functionality, which may be used by workflow at some times, that's one that's not exposed to the client object model. That's one where you still need a web service exposed on the server to go ahead and do it. So for list items in particular, there are those two update mechanisms for which, yeah, only one of those is exposed through client object model. Does that answer your question? No, this API won't do anything special that would sort of cause state transitions for documents to not get caught. The server does have that system update API where you would have that problem, but yeah, this one calls the one that causes all the state transitions to happen and events to fire, that type of thing. All right. Okay, so when you look at the actual fundamentals of the protocol, the idea was to take this sort of object-oriented API on the server, a set of types, and then represent them as a remotable protocol. And so the CSO protocol has definitions for things like what does an enum look like, what does an integer look like, what does a float look like. They correspond to fundamental .NET concepts. So a float, as far as the client object model is concerned, is implemented roughly the same way as it would be in .NET. There's types which, again, correspond to how those objects are represented on the server. When you actually go and make an XML request, there's two parts to it that we'll go into. One is called the object pass part, which defines a set of operations that will go instantiate or create an object. And then there's a set of actions, a set of behaviors, state changes that you can execute on top of those objects that you've defined via those object paths. You can also do queries against them to find out their core properties. So probably the best thing to do is to go ahead and show you how this works. So let's take a fictitious example of a sort of a book provider. And so the book provider, let's pretend that they have exposed on their server a simple API for getting at books and doing certain state changes to books, like let's say updating the author. So here I have some pseudocode that you can imagine written on the client where basically what I want to do is go grab a book called Contoso Stories, update the author to Lisa Andrews, and then after that is done, I want to go and retrieve all of the books that are defined in the book catalog. So just think of this as some pseudocode here for doing a basic property update. So when you look at this as a protocol and how it would be represented in CSOM, it's a little complicated, but let me walk you through it. So at the outer example, this is the request that will go over the wire to the server. And so at the top, you'll find some metadata properties about the request. Certain properties like what's the schema version, what's the library version, so that you can do version compatibility checks. And there's also things like application names that the server could potentially do some filtering or responses to that. Then there's two fundamental parts. There's the object pass part of it, and then there's the actions part of it. And so let's look at the object pass. What I'll do here is, what I'm defining here is, first of all, a static property. This corresponds to the catalog static property that you saw in that code sample earlier. Now off that, there's a books property. And you can see that the parent idea of this is the catalog object, and the actual idea of this books property is 19. And then there's a method that's been exposed on the books object called getByID. And you can see that the parent ID is 19, which is this guy, and it'll take a parameter called Contoso Stories. So these are three XML nodes here that define the set of objects that I want to go operate on the server. Now, on the left-hand side, you'll see a set of actions that are the things that we'll actually do with it. The first three of these, the object path tags at the top, basically say, go ahead and instantiate this object path. So go first fire this catalog, then go fire this books, then go fire this get by ID so that these objects are ready to be acted upon. Then the next thing we do is we call the set property action, which will go ahead and change the property of the object that's retrieved here to Lisa Andrews. And then it will call update, which, you know, in SharePoint's object model commits that change to the store. It's sort of, you know, an implementation detail for the backing server as to whether you have to explicitly call update or whether just by virtue of setting that property does it actually take on the backing store. But as far as SharePoint's concerned, typically there is a method called update that you have to call actually affect a change on the server to the backend database. So these first three operations sort of instantiated the objects, this changed the property, and then this called update. So now the author of the book has now been set to Lisa Andrews. Now the next part of this, we'll go ahead and then just do a query against these objects to return a set of data. And so here what you can say is, okay, do a query against the object with a path of 19, which is this books collection over here, and then retrieve all the properties of that book collection object, as well as retrieve all the properties of the children of the book collection. So this is essentially saying, give me all of the books and all of their properties in your store. Now, in most stores, you know, the set of books would probably be tens of thousands, so this is probably not a good idea of an API to call, but for simplicity, we'll just show you that what this looks like. And then the response will come back in JSON. And so for these operations over here where I'm instantiating objects, it sort of returns basically like sort of the equivalent of an OK, which is, OK, I've gone ahead and I've done that operation and it didn't return anything. And then when I actually do the query to actually retrieve all the books, I condensed this for space reasons, but basically you can see here that it returned two JSON objects that correspond to two books. And so in this case, it's returning one book called Contoso Guide to Living, which has these various properties, and then it's returning another book called Contoso Stories, which has been updated. What it was before, we don't know, but because we called some operations, we said set the author to Lisa Andrews. That's the new author of this book, and you know, some other information about that book in particular. Does that make sense? It's something you have to see a little bit in action to get a feel for it, and you know, this protocol wasn't, unfortunately, designed for sort of, you know, end user readability or understandability. It's designed to sort of encode operations. So I apologize for a little bit of the complexity of it, but that's sort of the fundamental structure of how to do an operation in CSOM. Now, of course, as far as SharePoint's concerned, it's not about books. It's about things that are sort of represented as concepts inside of SharePoint. So what we've represented as objects inside of the client object model that you can access is sort of basically corresponds to the fundamental structure of content inside of SharePoint. So there's this concept called a site collection, which is represented through the unfortunately named site object. And there's this concept of a web, which corresponds to a SharePoint site in end user terms. And then underneath this, there are the fundamental objects in a web that you can access, things like a list. So you can get, you know, the actual files and the sort of the schema for items that are stored inside of SharePoint. You can get the related forms and fields and views. You can get the actual list items themselves, which will have the metadata for items. So this is probably the very high value object that you want to access. SharePoint also has a folder hierarchy, essentially that you know, sort of sits alongside the structure of sites and webs and lists. And so you can get all the folders and files and sort of enumerate files that way. One of the files that we have inside of SharePoint is a concept called a web part page, which is an ASPX. And so you can get the set of web parts that are on that ASPX. There's some fundamental operations for getting at the change log. So the SharePoint has a concept of a change log, which allows you to basically inspect and get pull to get notifications of when certain objects or scopes inside of SharePoint has changed. So you can read that through the object model. There's end user interface concepts like a navigation node structure. So every SharePoint site has some navigation hierarchies for things like the quick launch on the left-hand side and the quick links at the top that you can access. User custom actions, which are extensions to the user interface that, you know, maybe somebody's added a custom link to the site settings page or something along those lines. Permissions are manifested through role definition and role assignment. And then I think as you just heard, some of the concepts of workflow like an association or a template are also manifested in the client object model. This isn't really a complete list of all the objects, but this just sort of gives you a feel for what's represented. Now what's not represented here are concepts like working with the social APIs or working with the user profile store or working with advanced taxonomy information like the tag store that we have inside of SharePoint 2010. Those aren't represented through client object model. You'd have to access those through SOAP. This is really just about getting the core concepts across. Questions about coverage? All right. When you actually look at the protocol itself, you'll find that it's divided into two protocol documents. One's called MS-CSOM, which fundamentally covers the, you know, the structure of the XML-based request and the JSON replies, you know, the set of, you know, types that are supported, the set of operations that are supported, the query syntax for doing queries against objects. We'll go into a little bit more of what that looks like in just a little bit. This just fundamentally defines the wire format, if you will. And again, it could be abstractly about books, but of course, in the real world, the only real implementation of types is the types that are exposed that correspond to SharePoint, these types that I talked about here. And so the definition of types is actually covered in MS-CSOM-SPT. So this defines how the site object works and its methods and its properties, and also all the exception semantics, so including what kinds of exceptions it will fire based on various conditions inside of SharePoint, that type of thing. The actual definition of types is also covered through MSDN as well. If you actually look for more information about a web, the protocol document has some great detail on it, but it's also manifested through MSDN if you want more information. And if you're familiar with the protocol, as you can see, that basically what these objects do is they go and wrap some calls to server-side objects. And so if you're working with a web object in the client object model, but you're sort of wondering as to why it's doing something funny, you might also be able to look up what spweb.title does, which is its server-side counterpart, to find out more information about maybe what people are saying on the internet about how that's working as well. Anyway, the CSOM-SPT has a lot of detail on these types, but just sort of pointing out that it's also more broadly available and it's developer-facing, so there's probably a lot of content out there on the internet about it as well. Okay. So for the out-of-the-box implementations of the client object model, there are some DLLs that are implemented for the .NET CLR 3.5 and above, as well as Silverlight. The Silverlight version is essentially the same thing as the .NET version, just compiled targeting Silverlight. Both of these DLLs are included with the SharePoint product, but if you're shipping, let's say, a third-party client that wants to talk using the client object model, there's also a redistributable that's available through MSDN that you can download to go run and use those types of objects. And that has sort of a redistribution EULA included with it, so that if you wanted to do that, you could. If you also want to develop on the server, there's some JavaScript that you can use. So we have some out-of-the-box JavaScript files. There's a runtime, which again defines the protocol semantics of how this CSOM protocol works, which is 68 kilobytes. But the actual library of types, the web object, the site object, the list object, all those definitions is actually a little bit hefty at 380 kilobytes. But these are some JavaScript files that you can use if you're actually coding JavaScript that was going to sit on the SharePoint server. Wrong direction. So if you actually wanted to use the CLR DLLs, just some common code snippets used with them, there's fundamentally this object called the client context object. If you think back to our book example, we had this object called the catalog object, which is sort of the root object where things hung off of. In the client object model, there's an object called client context, which serves this role as it's manifested on top of SharePoint. If you actually want to read properties, as far as .NET is concerned, there's a method called clientContext.load, and you pass in a pointer to the object that you want to load all the properties for. So that will essentially enqueue a query operation into the protocol so that when it goes to the server, it will fetch all the properties for that object. And then to actually go ahead and commit those calls to the server, you call a method called clientContext.executeQuery. So that's the fundamentals of using the DLLs and the JavaScript, but probably it's best to just show you a little bit of what this looks like. Okay, so here I've got a fairly standard SharePoint site. And one of the things I've done is I've actually deployed an ASPX page to SharePoint, which is basically a web page. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to use some JavaScript that will go fire some CSOM requests against the actual SharePoint server. So here what I have is, what I'll do is, when a test button is pressed, it will go instantiate a client context object, and then it will create this new object called list creation information. And this is an object that is basically used to hold properties that are used by the server to go create a list on your behalf. But you'll see things like a file creation information object or a web creation information object. That's sort of the standard for objects that are used for creating new things. So in this case, I'm going to go create a new list called created from JS. I'm going to set some properties like the template type, so I want to create an announcements list. I'm going to set some description. I'm going to put it on the quick launch. And then, in addition to that, what I'm going to do is go ahead and create a new list item as well that will go into that list. And so this list item basically just sets the body to hello from JavaScript. And then this final line of code down here will basically go send this over to the server. So you can see a little bit of the power and the reason behind the client object model. I was able to encode two fundamentally different operations, creating a list and creating a list item into that list into one round trip request. And so basically it's enqueuing all of these types of operations, and then when I call execute query async, it will go send them to the server. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go start Fiddler right here, which is basically a tool for Windows, if you're not familiar with it. How many are familiar with Fiddler? Okay, most of you. Yeah, if you're not, you really should be. It's a great tool for sort of inspecting requests that go from client to server so you can actually see the details of them. So in this case, I will go over to my sample page over here, and I'll just click the button. And an alert will fire that the request is done. So now when I go back to my web page and hit refresh, you'll see that there's a new list here called created from JavaScript. And inside of that list, you'll see that there's a list item that says hello from JavaScript. So this is my client object model script executing against the server. So if we actually look at what happened in that particular request, you'll find that there's a call here to VTI bin client.svc, which is the client object model. I apologize for this maybe being a bit hard to read. There's probably not really a great way for me to increase the font. Oops. All right, so, oops. Try finding this. All right. Okay, so let's take a look at this request. So if you look at the request itself, you'll see that we basically have two parts of XML here. This is just sort of a tree view representation of the XML that's been sent over to the server. At the bottom, you'll see this object pass node, which sort of returns all the various objects that we've worked with. And so the first thing it does is it has an object path for the current property, client context.current, and then it'll go get the web's property. So the current web that this page is contained within is what it will return, and then the set of lists in that web. So this is the list of lists that are in the web. And then it'll go call a method. Then it defines a method called add, which is rooted to this list object. And here's all the properties that I've defined for go ahead and for creating that list. So the title property, the template type, and that type of thing. And you can see that there's certain parameters here that I didn't set that don't need to be set to go create the list. But as far as the protocol is concerned, it still sent those from client to server with a value of null. So this went ahead and created the list, and then you'll see another object path property here for the actual add item operation. This is sort of defining an operation that will go add an item into the list. So that's the object paths. And then when you actually look at the actions, you'll see that basically it sort of instantiates all these different types of object paths. It does an object identity query to go find out the identifier of the newly created list so that it can do more operations against it. When it's all done, what it'll do is it'll automatically append some query operations to go fetch the data that were of the things that we've just updated. So when you create a new list item, it sort of assumes that you're going to want to start reading properties from it. So as a result of using the client object model on the client, it automatically enqueued this query operation to go fetch the properties of the announcement object that I just created. So that's the fundamentals of using some JavaScript in the client object model to go do some simple operations for creating a list and for creating an item. Right? Questions about that?
If I just to encode the use of the ID return from the first request in order to
Right. So that's encoded by the object identity query that basically says, hey, go find the, it knows enough to say, okay, we just created a list here, go find the identity of it and use that in sort of future operations. There are some cases where, I was sort of dealing with a demo I was running over the weekend where there's no way to do that. So for example, for creating a new field that's of type lookup, the API there sort of expects a GUID of the list you want to look up to. And so there are still some cases where you actually need to do two batches because in the first batch you need to get the GUID and the second batch you need to sort of send that. But in general, for most operations, it can actually do that within just one round trip itself. But for the lookup case, was one that I was just dealing with over the weekend. Okay, so the other part of the protocol is that there's some pretty powerful query functionalities as well. So here what I'll do is I'll just show a very simple .NET application. And so in this case, what this will do is just enqueue a request to go get all a list of lists from a SharePoint site. And so in this case, let me just go ahead and clear all my requests. So What this will do here is go retrieve the list of lists from the SharePoint site. And so it retrieved all the lists that have been provisioned inside of this SharePoint site. Let's take a look at the code for this. So if you look at the code for this, what I did in .NET is I just instantiated this new client context object. I called context.load on this context.web.list object, which said go retrieve all the properties of that list object as well as all of the properties of the child of the list object. And then execute query sent that over to the wire to the server and back again. And then it just did a simple message box. If you look at the actual protocol implementation here and what this looks over the wire, you'll see that it actually did two things. First, it called sites.asmx. Now, why did it call sites.asmx? In SharePoint, we have this concept called the form digest control. The form digest control is a security defense against cross-domain request forgery. And so the fundamental threat behind that is that certain clients don't respect the rules of the web and allow you to do a blind post from one domain to another. So if I know the domain of your SharePoint site, I can send a post over from my site, when you visit my site, over to your site to, let's say, go delete a SharePoint site. Now, they say that this isn't sort of a violation of the same origin policy because the client on the site can't actually read the results of that post request. You know, they can't actually, you know, let's say, read data, for example. But that doesn't matter. If they blindly posted over to your SharePoint site, they might have actually deleted it, and they don't need to read the result. The damage is done. So SharePoint has this defense called the form digest, which is sort of a feature of basically all of our web services and protocols. I don't know if anybody's already talked about it yet, where basically before doing operations from a client, you need to go fetch the form digest control, which is basically like a hashed encoding of state on the server that's sort of like a server secret, if you will. And that's what this does. And then for future requests to SharePoint, encode that form digest, you know, value onto your request so that SharePoint knows that you've been able to do a post, read the result, so it knows that you're able to safely make updates to SharePoint. And so this form digest operation here is really a security defense that we expect clients will do to sort of make sure that we can defend against those cross-domain blind post types of issues. So you can see here that this is just a very simple, this is just the authorization. So you can see what happened here is this is a SOAP request, and basically what it did was it returned a very long form digest value here, which is very long. And then when it actually made the client SVC request, we should be able to see it. You can see that there's an X request digest at the top here, which has that form digest essentially embedded. So that's just sort of one value of the protocol. Okay, so that's about form digest. Now, if you actually look at the CSOM part of this, you'll see that basically, let me go look at the XML view. You'll see that again, we have the object paths here, which sort of represent the current, the web, and the list, you know, sort of establishing that object model hierarchy that we have there. And then what it'll do is it'll say, go invoke this object, go invoke that object, go invoke that object, and then do this query and select all the properties on the object and select all the properties on all the child items of that object. And so that returns, you know, sort of fairly bulky XML as a result. You can see that there's a bunch of JSON here for all 24 of those lists, and it defines all the properties that are available for the list. And so let's see. You can probably see that the result of this, well, the result of this was 37,000 bytes, so that's not too big, but you can imagine that for certain collections where there's a lot of objects and a lot of properties, that could be a lot of data. So to help with that problem, CSOM has lots of filtering capabilities to allow you to scope down and select the sets of data that you want to return. So in this case, what I will do is, let's try, let me just go through a couple quick examples. So for query syntax, there's, in .NET, there's ways to sort of select the set of things that you want to return. So in .NET, I can say, okay, just give me the set of lists where the hidden property is set to false. And so this is just a very simple query to sort of remove the set of lists that maybe I don't want to see because they're marked as hidden. And so when I execute this query, you'll see that it only returns back 12 lists rather than 24, the ones that weren't hidden. And if we actually look at the client.svc for this one, you'll see that rather than just saying, okay, just go select all the child items and return all their properties, there's sort of an expression syntax here for being able to say, only give me the list back here that where, you know, using an equality function right here, get me back the list where this property called hidden is equal to this constant called false. And so there's also an expression syntax here for being able to sort of select and further winnow down the set of things that are returned. Okay, so that's just one way to filter it. There's also ways to sort of choose which properties to select. So if you, rather than getting all, let's say, 20 properties about a list, you know, whether it's hidden, you know, whether it has attachments, whether it supports major, minor versioning, you can also select the set of properties. So, you know, instead you can just say, just give me the title, just give me the ID of the list, I don't need those other properties, again, to sort of slim down the response set. A couple of other just advanced topics I want to cover real quick for the CSOM. There's this concept of exception handling. So when you want to call things on the server, sometimes those things will throw exceptions because maybe, for example, you want to operate on a list that doesn't exist, and that will throw an exception. There's actually concepts in the CSOM protocol for handling that case and actually specifying a set of actions that should occur if an exception should be thrown. So one of the cases that I have here, let me just go find the code. So in .NET code, this is manifested in sort of pseudo try-catch format. And basically what I'm saying here is, you know, wrap a bit of code, a set of operations that are going to run on the server in a try block. So attempt to go get this list called my sample list and set the description to in try block. But if that throws an exception, because the list isn't there, you know, here's a set of operations to run on the server as sort of a response to that. So in this case, if the my sample list doesn't exist, go ahead and actually go and try to create it. So this is just a case where I'm trying to ensure that a list is there. So if we actually run this script, first of all, keep in mind that there's no list here called my sample list. If I actually go and run this particular operation, should go do that. See? Try that again. So maybe. Let me just go double check that one. All right. Oh, let me go. I don't think I put it on the quick launch. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, I didn't put that in the quick launch. So, in this case, there's actually a list here called, because I ran the operation twice, it ran it the first time, created the list. And then I ran it the second time where I actually changed it in the try block. But if I went ahead and deleted this real quick, you'd see the demo. So I'm just going to go delete this sample list real quick. Let me try this one more time. Okay, so now you can see that there's a my sample list here where the code that was sort of invoked in the catch block was actually executed because that list didn't actually exist. Question? Because, yeah, when you actually look at the syntax of this, it does sort of, you know, maybe sort of make your head hurt a little bit. But the reason why we couldn't use try catch is because this is actually a set of operations that's getting enqueued and sent over to the server. And, you know, .NET, as a case in point, doesn't have, you know, that concept of here's a set of operations that are going over to the server to be executed in result. So we sort of tried to simulate that kind of concept by basically wrapping these things up in what's called a try scope or in a catch scope. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at the actual protocol for what actually happened, you'll see that what happened is for the set of actions, we took those set of actions that we'd normally invoke and we sort of wrapped them in these scope entities. You know, we also had some more commands that were sort of wrapped in a catch scope. And so all this stuff gets sent over to the server and then executed and returned back as a result. And, yeah, again, on the client, you know, as far as the client's concerned, we're just sort of creating a sort of a very oddly structured type of message that gets sent over to the server. All right, and there's also a concept of conditional scoping as well. So you can actually use the same set of expression syntax that we have for querying and for filtering down the set of objects to return. You can also use that to do some conditional scoping as well. So if a user doesn't have permissions to go access a list, for example, you can express that through an expression. And then have code that will fire depending on whether that value is true or whether that value is false. So, yeah, again, the scenario is if I don't have permission to a list, then go do this thing, put it in some other list maybe, whereas if I do have permissions to that list, then go put it in the sort of the list that you specified. So you can even do some very special types of conditional operations as well. All of this is around trying to make it possible to do, you know, many interesting and powerful things against the server in one round trip because that was what we're trying to optimize for. All right, so that's just a sort of a brief world tour of, you know, what you can do with the client object model in terms of sort of doing things like operations that do batch updates against the server, do sort of interesting types of queries. As a developer, you have the full power to express that. And we covered some of these advanced topics like exception handling and conditional scoping. Just a couple of other notes about the client object model. It has a very basic, crude file access mechanism where it supports getting files from SharePoint in a base64 encoded fashion. So as you might imagine, that's not the world's most efficient way to get documents or work with documents. In fact, it'll limit you to files of 100K or less. If you want to do file operations, then using a protocol like WebDAV is the preferred sort of alternative to that. And as far as authentication is concerned, the CSOM protocol supports all the standard SharePoint authentication models, NT-based, Kerberos, forms-based authentication. There's an issue with digest-based authentication, which I think we have some issues with sort of full support of that one. And you can also use some of the web services for forms-based authentication scenarios. There's a protocol called MSO-FBA, which is used to sort of describe how you would go about supporting Office 365. Fundamentally, that protocol looks like this, where basically what you do is you go sort of send a request over to SharePoint. SharePoint will point you Office 365. Office 365 will point you at a web page where a user can log in, and then you go grab the cookies and append that to your sort of further CSOM request. But Rob will actually go and sort of work you through a demo of that. One final brief topic I wanted to talk about was something called listdata.svc. So listdata.svc is a REST-based protocol for getting at SharePoint list data specifically. So the idea behind this one was to actually have a protocol that's a little bit more friendly and easy to use to make it possible to get data inside of a list. And the protocol is designed to be sort of friendly for developers, friendly to understand and work with, because it's based on JSON, it's based on Atom XML as well. Under the covers, this protocol uses the OData set of protocols. So this is a sort of an open protocol format. Microsoft is doing a lot of work with it, but the idea is that it's sort of an open protocol format that anybody can implement and use. And it defines a syntax for representing resources in a REST-style fashion and then working with that, again, via Atom or JSON. So just to show you what that looks like very briefly, so going back to my SharePoint server over here, because this is a REST-based protocol, I can very simply just prepend the VTI bin listdata.svc to my URL, and then specify the name of a list, and I've got a list here called tasks. And so here you can see that there's four tasks defined: do the dishes, mow the lawn, wash the car, take out the trash. It's returning this in Atom XML, so if I look at this feed, you can see that it's essentially Atom XML, although the OData protocol specifies ways to annotate this with sort of more metadata so that you actually know what the actual data is attempting to represent. And then there's also syntaxes for being able to do things like filter. So in this case, if I only wanted to find the tasks where a field on that task has, called status value has been set to completed, I can specify that through the URL as well, and that will return just the one task that's been marked as completed. So this just gives you sort of a preview and sort of an idea of this sort of REST OData-based protocol that we have. It's something that as we move forward, we really believe in OData, and sort of trying to make the protocol more friendly to developers and easier to access from a different variety of clients. And so OData is something that, you know, if you know, as we sort of move forward, is definitely something that, you know, just to, you know, give a little bit of sort of forward-looking advice, is something that, that we really think is a good standards-based protocol. So that's just listdata.svc in a brief nutshell. Hopefully put those two together. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. CSOM, listdata.svc. Any questions? Question?
Can you go back to the slide that shows the protocols, like the first slide?
Sure.
And maybe share about the motivations and background of the protocols. Like you said, that, for example, that the old data has a lot of internal use in Microsoft.
Yeah.
What are the original client application that started use? Which one of them?
So
the existing use cases today?
Yeah, so certainly the big one here is these, and again, this is sort of an oversimplification of the protocols, but so I'm going to leave out tons of protocols that are in existence. Historically, the SOAP-based web services were protocols that were exposed dating back to SharePoint 2003 for exposing the various functionalities that SharePoint had. Things like lists, things like being able to search over the corpus of data, do things with workflows, do things with web parts or social data. And so basically through SharePoint 2003 and SharePoint 2007, basically most of the functionality that was exposed remotely was exposed through SOAP. And so that was sort of the way to do it. Before that time, there were some protocols called Front Page Remote Procedure Call, which was a bit of a harder to use protocol for doing operations, and another one called WSS Remote Procedure Call. So those actually predated the SOAP web services and had some very specific intricate functionality with those, like updating the theme of a site and those types of things. So this was pretty hard to use, and SOAP was sort of deemed as sort of a replacement that was better. But as we approached 2010, there was a desire to make it even easier for developers to access and then sort of leverage SharePoint protocols and in a more standards compliant way. And that was sort of the idea behind OData REST APIs and sort of continuing to focus on web dev. So using things that developers are a little bit more familiar with and less, let's say, proprietary to SharePoint or sort of SharePoint-esque, if you will. So those are sort of two protocols that we definitely see as sort of more standards and sort of the right way to go for how we do protocols and how we want to present them moving forward. And then client object model was basically an attempt, to jumpstart some of our Ajax development, do some APIs to make it more efficient to do that. And sort of while we were at it, we decided, okay, we've exposed a lot of functionality here. Let's have things like a .NET DLL for accessing it as well. So that was just sort of another way to get functionality out to developers so they could take advantage of it, fill some gaps that maybe weren't covered through SOAP web services or through like these burgeoning REST-based APIs. So
as part of the development of SharePoint 2010, is there existing use cases that were developed for these protocols within Microsoft?
For
other customers?
So to repeat the question, so what were the use cases for, inside of Microsoft, and what were the motivations of these? So SOAP-based web services, I think you'll see a lot of usage of those by things like Office clients or other servers. So, for example, there's a version history SOAP web service that the Office clients use so that when you're actually opening up an Office document, you can go say, what's the version history of this document, and that will call versions.asmx. A SOAP-based web service hosted on SharePoint. So typically there's a lot of Office client users using these as well as other servers. For example, search crawlers will use them as well. For the client object model, again, a lot of the target of that was actually the JavaScript that we have on pages, although there are some clients like SharePoint Designer that also call client object model as well. But the usage of those is a bit more narrow and sort of focused, again, on like Ajax, that type of thing. Web dev, that's something that's used by Office clients to go sort of read and write files to SharePoint, but that's sort of strictly focused on files. And then OData REST APIs, that's, again, more focused on developers and sort of trying to come up with a protocol that's designed for ease of use by developers. The idea is that there will be more clients that just understand OData and so as a result can work with SharePoint as for free. Quote unquote. And so things like Excel's Power Pivot understand OData and can connect to SharePoint via that. But that's not, the idea is that they don't ever specifically code to SharePoint. They're just, understanding what OData is and then SharePoint exposes it. So that's the only client that I know of, well, that's the major client that I know of that uses OData, but the idea is that more clients over time will start to use OData as well. Question? Yeah.
What about web and software services? As far as I remember, IIS gets something like addition for 2 gigabytes.
So for actually uploading and downloading files, the question is what's the best preferred mechanism for working with files and what are the limitations around that? So for working with files, typically web dev is the one that's sort of least encumbered and sort of the best way for sort of working with files inside of SharePoint. Out of the box, most SharePoint sites actually have a limit on the file size that's held inside of SharePoint that's by default limited to 50 megabytes. And so typically that's something where people hit a limit first before they actually hit a protocol limit, so to speak. There are also some limits on the overall amount of time that can be spent doing an upload. I think for WebDAV, to be honest, I don't know whether it, I think it goes longer than the 2 minutes that typically web requests inside of SharePoint will fall under. I don't know the exact timeout that WebDev has. I could look that up for you. But otherwise, there's no particular limit in terms of overall file size for the actual WebDev protocol itself. But again, you'll probably hit the SharePoint file size limit first.
And files, you store them in the Microsoft SQL database?
So the question is for files, do we store them inside of the SQL database? So by default, we do, although it's possible with SharePoint 2010 and with SQL Server to have sort of a call out on the SQL Server side to what's called external blob storage. So SQL Server itself has a protocol for allowing you to, rather than store them literally inside the database, store them to, let's say, a SAN or something like that. In fact, there's also support in 2007 in a service pack for this sort of external blob storage mechanism. Yeah. So the question is there a way to work around the file size limits inside of SharePoint for, let's say, video types of scenarios? So the limit is 50 megabytes by default, but yeah, if you wanted to go larger than that, the site collection administrator, the IT administrator of SharePoint can choose to actually up the overall file size if they choose. But otherwise, as an end user, as a client of SharePoint, without sort of asking the IT administrator to up the overall file size, you can't. You know, in some cases for things like video, really large video, sometimes that's something where people store that on a separate server and then link it into SharePoint, perhaps. I've seen people do that, but yeah. As a client, you can't really work around that other than to ask the IT administrator to up the file size. So as an IT administrator, you can set it up to 2 gigabytes, I believe. For SharePoint itself, there's some best practices around SharePoint where we sort of recommend that people try to keep the overall database sizes, starting at 50 gigabytes to 100 to 200 gigabytes, because things like the amount of time you have to spend backing up that database for disaster recovery scenarios takes a long time. And so as an administrator, yes, you can you can increase the limit to 2 gigabytes for file sizes, but on the other hand, you know, that might cause like a sort of a management problem if users uploaded 100 2 gigabyte files, for example. So it's sort of a trade-off for the IT administrator to make. One more question? So the question is there any benefit to the client object model over the server-side object model, and does the client object model expose a subset? So the client object model definitely is a very big subset of the set of APIs that you can call on the server. And, you know, basically, if you can get code on the server and run the server-side object model, then that's going to be your most performant choice. The authentication will work better. We basically don't recommend that you call the client object model if you're running code on the actual server itself. So, yeah, you'll want to stick with server-side object model there. There's no benefit. Like all these protocols, they're really designed for remote only usage and not within if you have code on the farm itself. Okay, one.
Client object model be enhanced in the future to support the more non-foundation type stuff like document sets and taxonomies?
So the question is will the client object model be extended in the future to support more types of objects? Certainly we've heard that feedback about, certainly the objects that we do expose are pretty important, but there's certainly a lot of other objects that people want to get at. So we're certainly aware of the feedback and working to address feedback in a future release. I don't know. So we're definitely aware of that. We're looking at that type of thing. Okay, last question. Yeah. So CMIS is not on my list. That's another protocol that we definitely are investing in and working on. My list was sort of just, was abbreviated, but yes, CMIS is a good REST-based protocol that we also are supporting and investing in, and that's another one. Like an Excel REST is also not up here really, but yeah, it's a great, I should have included that on the slide. Somebody else could probably sort of comment on the CMIS. I believe that's been released, the adapter, but I'm not sure if anyone else can comment on CMIS. Michael? We can get you the answer for the status of CMIS. All right. Okay, well, I'll be here tomorrow as well, so if you have questions. Also, my email is mikeam@microsoft.com, so if you have more questions, feel free to email me.